Are you about ready to go to Las Vegas?
Okay.
Are we going to get started in Las Vegas? Is everybody there or? Yes, we can. Thank you. Is everybody present and ready to go? All right. I'll call this a jam session. We're at the point in the agenda where I wanted to throw open just a request that commission members identified areas of legislation only, that the commission should be looking at, amendments perhaps from the prior legislative session. There may be, as I mentioned earlier, resolutions to some of the issues that people have through rules. So we can get to that point. But I want to try to catalog areas that commission members perceive after working with the new statute where there might be a need for legislative change without necessarily debating it entirely today. I know that Ms. Buckley and James, maybe both have other commitments, so I'll start off with you folks, if you don't mind, to see if there are any topics or areas involving the current legislation that you think might require legislative changes. Then we'll touch on the email from Cassandra Jones. She and I have talked about some fixes that arise from the 2.2 raise, and then we'll throw it open to commission members to raise other questions. So, James or Barbara, would you like to begin, and then we'll move around the table.
What is the need? And some of them identify the need,
say, first of all, every child is informed. Well, that's, you know, right now, it's a 20-year-old. Now, that would be the upcoming year. The county doesn't have too much burden. But there are certain situations, perhaps where there is no consent by the minor in a minor garden system. This is where there is a non-family member who's in gardening staff, and you put an angel on it, or they put all of them, to ensure that the person, that the minor consent, that the person is appropriate, because there's a family, and it's not a family member, who is active on it. So those are two examples where,
comment, this is easy for the record. Barbara, I know I'm preaching to the choir, so please forgive me. I said before at the commission, without much authority, I think, but I say now with some authority, as a full-time criminal judge, I more negatively affect someone's constitutional rights, including a child, when I impose a guardianship over them than when I send somebody to prison, when I criminally convict them. And I deeply and profoundly believe that every kid needs to be represented. And so I want to help you in whatever way I can make that happen. I really think that, I think there was unanimity, I don't know just part of you if you have a different recollection, at the prior commission on this issue.
I think the concept is, I think one of the things though that is a concern is trying to ascertain the level of need in the minor guardianship area for counsel. And so Vince, you and Vince Potter are going to have to talk about this because I think there are gradations, if you will, a terrible term to use in this context, but of legal assistance to a proposed protected minor. And so it would impact how you allocate those resources. Caseloads are pretty substantial. So we'll put this issue on the table, but in order to move it forward, I think it's helpful for the two judges in Clark County as well as the judge assigned in Watto to confer with the legal aid organization to get some arms around what that demand would look like and what the problem what could be the problem there. Okay? Anything further, Ms. Buckley or James from Legal Aid Center?
Is absolutely 100% behind the conduct of incorporating for the decision-making on digital. Exactly. Because I know we're already on the legislative way,
Because there was no issue on that, that was always in full force and effect. So I think it's a matter of, if they're willing to have legislation, that's fine. But I also think it's a matter of educating attorneys to try and deal with these issues of trying to keep their clients out of the court. Judge, how do you feel about a modification of the statute that allows the judge to only appoint a guardian for the purpose for which it's been submitted, allow the power of attorney to continue for all other matters?
I think that would be helpful.
Okay.
Could that not be done by a rule? I mean, in theory, the statute talks about least restrictive alternatives. We have it in the Protected Persons Bill of Rights. Why not, under the auspices of least restrictive alternatives, say, I'm going to honor what you put in writing, and now we have, and it also happens with trust, when we think that trust covers everything, and we have to, you know, go into guardianship. I think the hope with all the new legislation is that we would be very tenuous in how we intrude on someone's life. So I'm thinking it's there already, and a rule might be allowable to clarify it.
Potentially, yeah. Jennifer?
Pastor Bosco Legal Services, I'm using Mallory, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I think we have had cases anecdotally where the authority has extended guardianship in a limited means and retained the power to the power of attorney. The only problem I see is when we've had a case where those are different people. The person petitioning for guardianship is different than the person who is the agent under the power of attorney. Then you potentially have a situation where they're acting and the right hand doesn't know what the left hand is doing. But I think on the point of what's taken that perhaps this could be something that we can construct for the rule.
This is Charlie Robinson. To follow up on Jennifer's, yes, I have actually had counsel file for a request for limited guardianship where there was a power of attorney in place, but we didn't leave the power of attorney for all other purposes, and only those limited reasons that weren't otherwise covered by the power of attorney were granted. So we sliced that as a limited process and just made it clear in the statute that the limited orders will not wipe out the power of attorney.
So John, would you and Danny add this to your growing agenda? And I'd be interested in knowing whether you think that there is room within the statute for a rule to permit a judge to exercise the discretion Judge Ochoa seeks.
Absolutely. And we've done the same thing in the past. We've had to craft our orders, and some judges over the years have done that, so they face the standards and so forth.
It's easier to have these conversations when the statute's right in front of us. I doubt anybody has this clearly in their mind. If you do, good for you. But I think we have to look at the statute and see what flexibility is present to interpret the statute for the judges to operate to what administering needs. The other point I would add about this, it kind of gets to the point I believe that Homer was making about the termination of these things. I can see some real problems where the guardianship is ended, but banks or other people you've been dealing with are saying, hey, we don't have an order to sell this, we need to know we're out. And we expect a lot from third parties that we're dealing with. And I don't blame them for being gun shy and not wanting to walk away from their understanding that the guardianship is still in place. So it's kind of the same type of situation.
Well, in that scenario, I think that if you, which I talked in this book out about, and she has pointed out that in a way, if a guardian is failing to act appropriately, why is the quote-unquote punishment to remove them from responsibility and, in effect, abandon the individual that the court already determined needed help? And it's kind of this limbo. We have numerous cases right now across the age range where somebody's guardian is removed for not showing up to court, but we know that person's receiving services in Las Vegas, and now they can't go to the doctor because the doctor won't allow them to consent to anything because this order says mom's no longer your guardian, and it says nothing about that their rights have been restored in any way. You make this decision.
I was going to say, I think there's actually two separate issues there. Removing a guardian does not reinstate that person to full capacity and should require evidence that that person can be returned to capacity. So those are two
conclusions. Well, the statute for removal and termination, they're all kind of live in several different places. And if you line them up next to each other, one doesn't call out the other one. Mm-hmm. And then I think in 253, there's even guidance about with public guardians that I remember litigating the issue of you can't just step aside once all the money's gone and nominate the public guardian. But, you know, there's responsibility there. There's fiduciary obligations to be. So I think that when we sat down with it, there are different opinions across the state, and I have acknowledged that maybe my take on it is not clear in the statute, you know, or vice versa. I think that it is a question, and that it would tie in with this restoration, or does the power of attorney, you know, revive somehow when the court proceeding that suspended it is no longer applicable. I think that's all important to discuss, and the judges are the ones having to think on their feet in these hearings. You know, they're dealing with the hearing as an order show cause, maybe why a guardian didn't file a report, and they're dealing with the decision before them. I don't know from a due process standpoint if they should be venturing into the other situations, or should a counsel be appointed. Before she left, Ms. Jones made the point that privately deemed, that we've seen a lot, for example, Douglas County will not appoint counsel for protected persons unless there is a new case or there's a pending hearing. So we have those situations where we can't get these things on calendar or get counsel appointed to assist someone who's in that limbo where a guardian has been removed and, you know, nothing has been done. So I didn't mean to take it far afield, but it might be a coexisting issue of how do we deal with the before, during, and after. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, John.
Another one in 162A. It says that if you have power of attorney, you have to have a corresponding, if the person's in the facility, you have to have a corresponding certification from the physician. So the idea is if you're in a system living in a hospital or something, just because of the medication, your illness, your marriage, you know, time to change, you've got to have a certificate from a physician to execute the POA. And I think that's showing online is in my perception, people are doing that. But what the statute is silent about is, can you, while you're in the hospital, attention on medication and everything, should you be able to terminate the POA? So I had a situation where I initially represented one side of the family, and we were trying to stay out of judge and get court, and they had POA. It was all done properly. I had not done it. It was done, not my wife was done properly, but it was done. And so they had POA, and you were moving along and avoiding guardianship and doing some things. And then the other side of the family came in, literally, I had records on them at nighttime. And I don't know why they did this, but one of a licensed counsel nurse, Pam wrote a revocation on a piece of paper, and then took it in and got the grantor to sign this revocation that revoked our POA. Which then thrust us into contention with guardianship court. And I thought to myself, the other kind of safety requirement to execute a POA, but then the statute's silent, can you just find medication to terminate it? So I wondered if there was any type of consensus from the group about some legislation that says you also can't go and get grandma terminated if you're in a hospital or if you have a physician certification.
What do other committee members think?
Not to make you guys hear my voice. This is something we deal with a lot with protective services, also in the context, however, of the bad, quote-unquote, power of attorney who's acting in an abusive manner and the individual would like to terminate their authority and, you know, and select someone else. I would argue that where the statute is specific, so 162A is specific as to the establishment of a power of attorney and the silence on that capacity question for revocation. If we look at the law generally, a person has capacity until they've been adjudicated otherwise. Therefore, the position that the state has taken is that you can revoke a power of attorney at any time under any circumstance unless you have been adjudicated by a court of law to be incapacitated. Now, it does result in some absurd situations, but then the recourse would be to go to guardianship court, appoint counsel, that's where that safeguard is so crucial, and really have that discussion because that person has a right to revoke the authority even if they don't have the ability to issue a new one. Especially, we deal with it a lot with fraudulent powers of attorney. We had a case recently that Washoe Legal Services assisted us with under our grant where a facility fabricated or convinced the doctor to say that the person lacked capacity. So on a Monday, they signed it authorizing a power of attorney. The gentleman signed the power of attorney. Day two, on Tuesday, they signed him into memory care using that power of attorney. So on Monday, he had capacity to sign. On Tuesday, he didn't. So we see families taking people out to lunch, thinking that while you're out to lunch, you aren't living in a facility. I mean, we see some very weird situations with 162A. So I think it would be better that when things get murky like that, that we have to go to court. And I'm not for, guardianship where it's not necessary, but obviously something's afoot and we need to talk about it and get that person counsel urgently.
Do you support a piece of legislation that says that you can't revoke a
from an individual rights perspective, I would not support legislation that wouldn't allow the revocation, because already it's hard enough to get the revocation of a POA honored. So we have situations, I may have mentioned this before, we had one where a power of attorney was ordering the facility to give the individual salt water because people used the ocean had healing properties. And the facility, we're arguing and saying, you don't have to honor this. This is way outside the scope of what's medical. But we have to understand that the culture is that the statute gives certain protections to the reliance, the good faith reliance on a power of attorney. And facilities really, really go full bore onto that. So I think it's important to retain the right to, even if you don't have the capacity to establish a new power of attorney, you might, in the same vein as supported decision making, you can't cut someone off from the right to choose who they trust and who they don't trust, and I think that gets into dangerous territory when you don't allow someone to revoke and bring it to a different forum. And if people complain to me and say, well, but it would be so much easier and so much cheaper to avoid guardianship by continuing with this power of attorney that they say they don't want, and they're just confused, but I think that we minimize too much people's decision-making capacity when their memory declines. And just not knowing what day of the week it is or whether I paid my electricity bill doesn't mean I don't know whether I trust my son or daughter. Mm-hmm. So that's where we're at. It's
mine.
Yeah,
that's all register. I guess I agree with that person should be going to court. Somebody should be going to court. But I think the fact that with a person's capacity in that question, they shouldn't be able to act one way or the other under the POA statute 162A. That at that point, the people who are wanting them to revoke it need to go to court and bring the issue up before the guardianship court that this person is incapacitated and their power of attorney should not be honored because. And that it should go to court, I agree. But they should not be allowed to revoke it in the meantime. That's something that would be appropriate for an emergency guardianship that would allow the judge to suspend the power of the appeal and the hearing.
So James, in the cases you folks have you seen a collision between the POAs and guardianship?
No. I don't know of any cases where that's been a problem. Yeah. So I've seen guardianship come to an end years later, like 4 or 5 10 years, and a lot of people who didn't take a power of attorney that is 5 years old, and I said, there's nothing in the practice that I can do that. And I don't want to be in a position where such a person on Monday says yes to somebody, and then on Tuesday says yes to another person, and then they both come in the board and said, we agree that I could be the person who's under power of attorney and changes his mind from Monday to Tuesday. and the person already suspected of having some sort of dementia. So it makes it difficult. So I would like to have a statute that says these are grounds you can consider, you know, setting an hour or something, or something in all of the things.
Justin Sherman, have you had any of these yet?
And I think the out-of-state powers of attorney, I must see a lot of them. I'm getting very familiar with every state's power of attorney statute, because technically Nevada will honor it if it's valid in another state, and we have a lot of transplants. And there's just, you know, California is interesting, because when you are incapacitated, your power of attorney terminates unless it specifies otherwise, which is an interesting situation, because people think they drafted it, they think it's going to help. But the second you're deemed incapacitated by a physician, your power of attorney ceases to function. And so that's something I caution people about. If they move to Nevada, maybe draw up a new one, because they don't realize that it's not going to still have a factor. So it's a pretty good
one. Bright line rules.
Yeah.
And the other issue under this power of attorney statute that needs to be addressed is the certificate of the physician, certifying that person is capable of entering into one. I've recently been informed by some of the licensed nursing facilities that the certificate of physicians are being questioned by the licensing entity on what they're based upon and whether that person has had many mental status exams or other testing done that the physician relied on, and that is not referred to in this statute. So I understand the need for it, but that might be something that needs to be added to the statute.
Jennifer Watson, Legal Services. I would just say, from protected persons perspective, counsel, and also having worked for at the senior law project for 2 years prior to that, we would see powers of attorney being abused quite often, especially as a means to control the person or to try to force them into some kind of nursing home situation that they did not wish to go live in, and taking away their ability to revoke that would be very harmful, because the client that we would get, the power of attorney is very broad, the statutory form, and its interpretation with facilities and nursing homes is also very broad. So we've seen family members use it to place persons against their will or threaten that. And if the person wants to revoke it, they threaten all sorts of things, and that's not something necessarily that we should take away. It's their right to challenge that unless they've been completely incapacitated.
Okay. Don, if you and Daniel would kick that around, but we'll leave this on the list. It does appear as though it's a pending issue for sure.
And I can provide my notes in there. This is something that we've had to brief extensively, at least internally, and I can send you my notes and the citations so you have a starting off point about where it all
seems to go. Anybody else have any burning issue with the current legislation that you'd like to see addressed? Yes, down in Las Vegas, then Daniel, then Kate.
This is Mary Kelly. Myself and the local librarians actually have some conversations of the leadership and did provide their traditional reason as a home nursing. A big part of the mission for us would be services to move, which I know we've been talking about a lot, but that I think has been a major problem. But once coming to something that we are working through, especially when the majority of the cases are the programs protected, are going in and out of hospital. And that's why I'm seeing something in the hospital to try to attend. What we've been trying to do is kind of consider it more of an emergency that, depending on who you're talking to, you're trying to
So I have a favor to request, because this has been bouncing around since this commission began. I'm working with the public guardian up north. Take the statute and let's do a red line of your suggestion, so we have a piece of paper in front of us and can discuss alternatives or mitigation to that issue. I'll be the first to acknowledge that the notification issue was clearly something that arose out of the last guardianship commission. Maybe this went too far. So it's worth looking at a little bit more with a little bit more circumspect approach. But at the examples that we got in the previous commission, which is hiding protected person, which is, so the best way to stop that was to give these notices. And I think people's lives have to be read, and that includes protected persons, and so they've got to go to a hospital, or they're going to go away for the weekend to relatives or whatever. So I can see how cumbersome that could be. And it's probably not something that is resolvable by a rule. I did take a few minutes to look at this over the weekend, and the language seemed pretty clear and unambiguous. So I don't want to foreclose that case, but it certainly appears as though it's pretty definitive. So if you folks wouldn't mind taking the statute and doing some redlining on it, we can discuss that further. Was there another issue, or Daniel, I know you had something else, but did you have anything else, Kelly?
I just have one other quick one. In regards to the personal policy, why do you think that it's come up when we're offering the first time of approval to family members? Is you would get multiple family members coming back and they want to start identifying or purchase something. And if you know something that you think is an order of priority that you go by, it's kind of a family member. So what we've kind of been doing and what everything
okay, then I ask you to do the same thing. You want to try to approach the offer or right of first refusal to the lineage priority? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. Danny, did you have anything else?
Ms. Polly had echoed what I wanted to talk about in terms of the change of location and residence. I recognize from the prior commission that a concern was that individuals can move and essentially almost from family members, and that was a concern. And truthfully, that can happen out of a hospital as easily as it can happen out of somebody's home or anywhere else. So perhaps the legislature meant what it did, but it is a large part of it when we have a number of litigious arguments with hospitals in our jurisdiction regarding the 10-day noticing. Because it is clear that if somebody goes into a hospital and they're not going back to their original residence, it falls not under the change of location protocol, but the change of residence protocol, which is dictated by the 10-day notice. If they're just going back from where they came, you don't have to give the 10-day notice. But if the residence is actually changing to a stepped-up level of care or something else, you have to give the 10-day notice, and it creates a problem for somebody who needs to care that doesn't belong there, and the placements are few and far between. if somebody's on Medicaid and they don't have an independent pay source to pay both for the hospital and the whole replacement for 10 days, that patient is gone. So it's very, very problematic. And I agree, I looked at this sideways and upside down and with as many people as I could since we came on board, and I can't find a way to write a rule out of it because it's really clear in the legislation. So, yeah. In regards to the colleagues at the point on the order of priorities for family members, I don't know what the thoughts are of maybe fleshing that out in a rule for order of priorities, or whether that truly should be stopped at first. So I'll just kind of throw that out there first. A great thought on the death penalty when we come back around to it.
I think it probably needs to be stopped at first. If family members have a right of first refusal, I don't know how a court rule solves that problem. Every family member is going to say, well, I have an equal right, mm-hmm. unless the legislature prioritizes it, then it would be pretty tough to
kind of along the lines of saying, I
say,
yeah. Okay. Just for the point of information.
I'm sorry, were you done, Daniel?
Oh, yeah.
So Hank Cavalera, just for the point of information, NRS 162A250.2 says that if a guardian is appointed, the power of attorney terminates unless the court allows the agent to retain specific power conferred by the power of attorney. In the event the court allows the agent to retain specific power, the agent shall file an accounting with the court and the guardian on a quarterly basis or such other period as the court may designate. So I just throw that out there. If the committee wants to look at that in terms of changing a little bit for legislation, that's fine. But it's clear now that I could put that in my power of attorney. I would assume that if it came before a court, the court's going to say, okay, this is what the agent wanted, the court's going to follow that. But I mean, there's no guarantee. But in any event, it is in the statute. And Justice Hardy, if you didn't think about any legislation, I noted that in the last session there was all this funding set up for court appointed attorneys and investigators and so forth, but there isn't any funding for GAO. And I didn't know what the judges had in mind if it was a guardian ad litem was going to be appointed, would it be that the guardian ad litem would be paid out of the protected person's estate, or how do we see that happen? Or would there be a carve out or some other fund, or what are the situations?
Well, at the moment, if there are funds, it comes from the estate, but I still think it's important that we define the role of the GAL in this context, and until that definition gets resolved, how it's compensated is a separate question.
Well, that's why I raised it, because I wanted to get to that issue. So it's my understanding that under the Nevada rules of professional conduct, if you have a client with diminished capacity, then if you're the advocate counsel, you have to take appropriate steps to safeguard the best interest of the person you're appointed to help. So, when the physician certificate was finalized by the committee, it has a, in section G, section 1, paragraph G, it has a whole section there about the person's cognitive impairment. Theoretically, if the physician comes back and says, you know, the person's got problem 1, problem 2, problem 3, problem 4, and then the physician says that under 159.019, I think the person is incapacitated. Well, the petition is filed, court gets the petition, and they appoint counsel before the hearing. Counsel goes out, meets with a client, and either two things happen. One, the counsel says, oh my gosh, this is true, the person doesn't have any capacity, and guardianship is appropriate. Then, my understanding is the duty of court appointed counsel to go into court and say, Your Honor, I can't help this person because I think the person is in fact incapacitated and needs the help. The other scenario would be, well, I went out and visited with the person. The person's health is being restored a little bit. I'm not sure whether the impairment's going to last. So I'm going to, Judge, I want to stay on the case until this is cleared up a little bit, but I still think it's appropriate to have a guardian ad litem come in to represent the best interest of the protected person. So I see that you can have either a guardian ad litem and an advocate counsel in the same case, or you could have a situation where advocate counsel is forced out of the case because the person can't formulate a student-client relationship, and then you have to go to a DAL. We skirted around this, and nobody's really brought it up, and I think it's something to talk about, particularly if we're going to consider these things as the next rule.
Well, for sure, and that needs to be discussed in the rule part, but I've always wondered what the role of a DAL is when there's an existing guardian.
And the question is how far does the DAL, how far does the role of the DAL extend?
Or should it even exist? Where does the guardian exist?
Well, if the case is filed and the advocate counsel makes a determination that based upon the physician's certificate and their own investigation, that the protected person, the proposed protected person, cannot engage counsel and is in fact incapacitated, I think they've got a duty to come forward to the court and ask the court to find a DAL.
Why not a guardian?
Well, because somebody has to do my understanding of the role of the DAL is to do an analysis of the case, what the best interest is. Are the guardians the right people to do it? They filed a proposed care plan. Is that the right way to do it? I've talked to the family members, and, you know, there's this conflict. And so
here's my point. We have this whole mechanism. We've got a whole pile of statutes that direct the authority, the supervision, the accounting, the administration of a guardian. We don't have that in place for a DAL. Courts routinely appointed guardians ad litem in litigation just so they have a representative that had the competency to carry on the litigation. But where was the supervision of the DAL? It was a trial court judge who's worried about getting a product liability case on the list. And the only thing they care about, the only thing they primarily are dealing with, is settling the case and making sure that where is the settlement money going. But the rest of the life of this individual who's been identified as requiring a guardian ad litem is out there.
Well, I think the role is that if the person does not have the capacity to engage advocate counsel, I don't think the court has to appoint a guardian ad litem, but the court wants to balance the courtroom, then the role of the guardian ad litem is to be the best interest advocate for that person. And the best interest might be, in fact, yes, Judge, I believe that this protected person needs a guardian. I've done an investigation, and I do, in fact, believe that the petitioner is the proper person to do it. So you can have that.
So let me ask the judges, let me ask other people here. Is there a difference between the role of the guardian ad litem and the role of the guardian of the person in a state, in a state of a protected person? If so, what is that difference? Because I can see a tremendous difference in accountability. There's a lot of accountability over the person of the estate. I'm not sure what the full accountability is to the guardian ad litem.
The guardian ad litem is appointed by the court. They're not through the court.
Well, yeah. Jeff, Jim?
Number one, on adult guardianship in South County, once the attorney is appointed, even if they cannot form an attorney-client relationship, they stay in on a case to protect the individual. So they're in the state. On guardian ad litem, I sometimes want to use them in my notes in the appointment or in the discussion of appointing a guardian in a minor case to see if the person is better than that person and whether the parent should be let back into child's life. So, there's a major difference in guardian and guardian in a minor case. Sometimes I use them. I call them investigators slash guardian and guardian, but because there's money for investigators, not guardian and guardian.
So your question was, what's the difference between the guardian ad litem and the guardian? I think that it might be an issue between the difference between the guardian ad litem and counsel for the protected person. We do have cases where the protected person, for example, we reveal that the guardian is abusing the individual, and the protected person's counsel says no, but they want that person to be their guardian. And so sometimes the issue may be that there are things that are not being, which goes to the authority's letter that we have written about wanting to know about things that might be going awry. I think that the one situation, I was appointed to represent an individual who was in a persistent vegetative state. So I was appointed to be his counsel, and the first thing I did was petition the court for a DAL, and my argument was, I can't communicate with my client, I can't even know what he wants, and this petition was denied. And I was told that the reason I was brought in as counsel is because it was a withdrawal of life support, life-sustaining treatment case, and the judge felt that the other, both sides weren't doing enough to present the evidence. So I was tasked with, you know, I deposed 5 neurologists. It was just very, you know, it was right after the Hailey case, and unfortunately he passed away in the process. But so I can see where there would be factually a scenario where it's possible that a guardian ad litem is needed to further inform the court, and then the decision making is still very much within the judiciary, because what was happening in Clark County previously when these purported guardian ad litems were coming in is that the judge is taking their report and adopting it wholesale, which I think has some evidentiary problems, right? They're going out interviewing people, people are being deprived of the right to confront somebody who is making accusations. So I think that there's a place for it, but it's, the hope is that If we bolster the ethical rules regarding protected persons counsel, wouldn't we be addressing the concerns that people used to use guardians ad litem for? The statewide compliance office, if they're invited by the judge into the case, they would serve that role. So I think your point taken that we have so many safeguards, the hope is that the old ways of using CALs have been addressed in protected person counsel and the compliance office and all these things, but I can see where the question is right.
Well, I don't know that it's been addressed. I know when I was a trial judge, I'd get routine requests for the appointment of the GAL in a personal injury case. Probably without thinking too much about it, I would sign the order without appreciating what I just put in place. And so I don't know that there's a lot of guidance about this issue. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to committee to that is that I still think that there's some open questions about the role and when it should occur and when it's appointed. James, have you run into any CAL collisions with your guardianship cases?
I look at it from my community. There is a role for a GAL in certain limited circumstances. Under one rule, 1.14, the counsel for that person, if you adopt the traditional attorney-client relationship to the extent that they can. So our job is to be the advocate for what the client wants. Now, obviously, if we can't form an attorney-client relationship, then we take on a legal interest model where we say, okay, they need to protect the legal interest, but we do not advocate for what we think is best for the client. So, if there is a situation where the judge has some question about whether the petitioner is the proper person to guardian, or whether it's in the best interest of the client, we would not be the person to advocate for what is the best interest. So, essentially, there could be a role to bring in a guardian ad litem to do an investigation and give them their opinion for what they can do
But honestly, I had a guardian ad litem, and only the only thing was one kid that had a guardian ad litem.
That's an exact, that's a great statement. That's what I believe, in fact, is the true rule. Because you can stay, you stay in the case, you send in a advocate to counsel. If an attorney-client relationship cannot be formed, you can still stay in the case to make sure that the legal protections are in place. But you cannot then advocate best interest. And if there's a best interest issue, let's say you have two sides of the family arguing, the court might want to appoint a guardian ad litem for the purposes of essentially doing an investigation, which might involve the suitability of the guardian, a proposed guardian that might involve issue about care and safety and those kinds of things, which I think are something that we want to make sure it happens. So I appreciate the statement because I think that's absolutely correct.
So in that situation, you take it out of time, there are two family members who are fighting over guardianship. A lot of times they tell us which family member they want, and we do our role in trying to make sure that all the facts come out and are presented to them so the judge can make a determination about whether the client is their interest. But I can see that as an opportunity to the judge wanted for to appoint a GAL to go out and move them out of the case.
So who is the lawyer for the GAL? Usually there is not a man, there will be no rest.
Well, I think that just depends, but if an attorney is appointed, I think that, you know, this is all registered, doesn't require an attorney. I recently had a couple situations where we've been asked to serve as guardian ad litem in divorce situations where one of the parties is impaired and unable to assist counsel in obtaining information. What we've kind of discovered in such an unusual situation is we're allowed to consent to provide medical records, obtain financial records, that type of thing. But when we actually sit down and talk about what about settlement, the individual in the current case is refusing to come to court. And so counsel's left there in a situation. We discovered that, well, the guardian ad litem can't substitute for that person at that point, and it was determined that as guardian, the person in the state needed to be sought to step into that person's shoes. So that it kind of depends on what's needed to assist counsel. In the last case, we have our own separate counsel.
I would think so. Jennifer?
Hi, Jennifer Walker, Legal Services. I was just going to echo what Mr. Birchfold said. In my caseload, I think I maybe have one case with a GAL, and that's a very unique situation. But on the whole, we don't see any for that need of our advocacy, as you mentioned.
Okay. All right, let's move on. Are there any other topics that people want to raise? John?
I should just add that in the model role that Mr. Birchfold cited, it does say that when you're representing a person in any capacity, you have to tell if you represent them. But the next part is, when a lawyer reasonably believes that a client has diminished capacity, is at risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm unless action is taken and cannot adequately protect their interests, the lawyer may take reasonably necessary protective action, including consulting with individuals and entities that have the ability to take action to protect the client, and in appropriate cases, seeking the appointment of guardian ad litem. I just feel like that section there gives us some leeway to say, to maybe with a rule or something, to say, hey, it may not be a full guardian ad litem. My concern is, if there's already a budget to get counsel in there, then how do we get guardian ad litem in there for all these cases? Maybe we, and I think that another issue is that this virtual edit, wonderful time working with him on this case, but there are a lot of attorneys that our office deals with, and we have some attorneys who vigorously fight the guardianship, even though the person is comatose, like an educated state, because they think that they're supposed to oppose no matter what, rather than stepping out of it. So we would love to see some massaging of that to say, let's have some reasonable standard. I know when I did appointment in court, I read this rule and I thought, like, okay, I'm going to tell if you represent them, but I feel that I have some leeway to make a disclosure and confer with people about, you know, ordering up to best interest of the person without violating my ethical rules because they have diminished capacity. And the model rule talks about that.
Okay. Oh, here's the committee to go.
Yes, the other is that I'd like to ask for discussion about is the notice to the protected person, of post-protected person, and then ongoing notice to the protected person. I understand in the circumstances that, you know, people should be given notice, but there are some circumstances that they can be harmed by giving notice or they have no ability to understand the notice. With the appointment of counsel in every case, it seems to make the notice to the proposed protected person something that could allow the judge some discretion in determining, such as in the same circumstances, whether a person has to appear in court or not, based upon whether they can be excused, or whether the appointed counsel can receive their notice on their behalf. That's been in much other litigation areas, and some of my attorneys are having trouble understanding that they cannot accept service on behalf of their client because they do that in every other situation. So I think that's an area I've got complaints, and I've got some statements, although they lack specificity of the individual, but I'll try to get as much information as I can, where the memory care telling me that this individual, every time they get a package, they think that their husband is after them, and their husband is deceased. They just don't have the ability to understand that what's happening with these legal papers. And then they said when they finally figured out what was causing this person so much upset, they went in and tried to pull some of the paperwork and put some paperwork elsewhere, and they realized some of the financial information was, you know, touching this person's death door or drug or drawers that their staff has access to. Anybody who goes into the room has access to. So, and they're not able to protect themselves from anybody accessing their information. So, I think that there are some circumstances and situations where notice to the proposed protected person could not occur directly by direct service. And the other part of it is I don't know whether if those people have to be personal service. That's causing it and another costly situation that people don't understand why that's having to occur that
way. So let me ask James and Jennifer about the legal aid organization. How do you feel about entering waivers of service on behalf of your client?
Thank you. Generally, we do not have a practice except service on behalf of our clients. I can think of maybe one situation where we did waive service.
And why, maybe you could comment a little bit as to the policy behind
that. I don't have a statute in front of me, but I believe it states requires personal service on the person.
Mm-hmm.
So due to the language of the statute, the petition itself must be served on the person. I think that documents that are subsequent to that, there's the ability for counsel to accept those documents on behalf of the person, but the petition itself, due to the language in the statute, it's our position that we cannot accept or waive service.
Well, no, I realize that. I think what Shelley's talking about, though, is the documents after you've been appointed accepting service from those. There seems to be some concern that the protected person must be personally served with all of those post appointment documents. And that's what they can do. James, how about you?
And we should clarify that in statute as well.
So, our policy is the same as lack of motor because we only have service. On the post, as the garbage is actually in place, yes, we would have service we have to apply to the legal position, that obviously requires a statute.
I'm certain from the deliberations of the last commission, that should not change. But the question I think Kelly is posing is, once the guardianship order has been entered, or maybe even once counsel has been appointed, from that point forward, those subsequent pleadings can be served on counsel if they waive personal service.
So if you want to take that question back to me, I'll speak with our internal.
Okay, thank you. Okay. I appreciate that. Okay. But James, so as I understand it, your attorneys are accepting service on behalf of your client, and either waiving the requirement of personal service if the statute compels that on subsequent pleadings. Is that right?
Right.
Yeah,
maybe
what
he's after that. I was just wondering if there's any way that this could be part of maybe the initial order from the government where the judge has to be present to the day, the protected person, the service should be a month. By that time, you know whether this person is going to handle things or medical things versus not, and it would be a fee simpler to allow the judge to say, same as the right to vote, same as the right to hold a gun. This includes another 10 spots on that order.
I don't see why not, and that doesn't require a legislative change. So let's look into that as well. I think. Ms. Crickfield?
I have always served the attorney. One thing I'm interested in is because I've always been mindful of the citations that have said that to communicate directly with a represented person is a potential violation.
Well, unless it's mandated by statute, that's the question here.
I understand in the past, you want to take out the initial step that sends that model.
Okay, well, let's take a look at that. I was thinking that the statute as amended requires personal service of everything. And so I'm not sure that it's waivable, but maybe it is. So that's why I was curious as to what the practices are by the legal aid organizations once they're appointed. And maybe if there's enough room in the statute that we can resolve that by rule, or more importantly, we can resolve it by a court order that excuses the requirement of personal service on the individual further than showing that wouldn't be appropriate. But I'm going from memory. I'll defer to other people who were on the prior commission. I thought personal service of everything was a big issue in those commission deliberations. So the expectation was, now admittedly, they didn't have lawyers, so now they do have lawyers, so maybe that can be relaxed some, and I can see where it creates, as Cassandra's email pointed out, some real confusion on the part of someone who is subject to a guardianship, and angst, frankly, over getting a bunch of papers and not knowing what this is about and what it means and so on. So I think it's worth looking into, and let's see whether or not it's a legislative change or perhaps a rule or a court order change, as Lynn suggests. The other point I wanted to raise was it arose out of Cassandra's email. She had to read. But I told her I would bring it up, and I thought her point was very well taken, that records that are confidential should remain confidential between and among all the parties interested in the guardianship. Her concern was that some interested persons will violate that confidentiality. And I think to the extent that any amendment is needed to the statute, either that or chapter 22, that was subject to contempt. The confidential records, once deemed by the court to be confidential, are protected records. Maybe they are provided to the parties in the case, but it's like a protective order. You can't release this stuff to third parties who are not in the case. And it seems to me if you take the protected person's medical records and share them with people who are not in the case, you run the risk of violating the confidentiality of the protected person. So I think it's a fair question. What remedy is available to the protected person and to the judge, for that matter, to address the misuse or the divulgence of confidential records in a case? The sealing records rule may have an answer in this. I haven't had time to look, but I think it does. That's the rule, frankly, that results in all this stuff being confidential in the first place. But we may need to spell out a remedy. I don't know whether lawyers have run into this problem, as Cassandra had identified in her email. Said Walker,
I've been forced to twice using the internet for 10 hours in court. In other words, I can think of a couple of divorce cases, for example, when it first some opposing party gets a hold of a PSI, which by statute was sealed, except to the DA, the defendant, his attorney in the court. And I just said it as an order shall cause. And one other 432G record, same way, that had been published outside the confidential nature of the case.
Yeah. Well, I can see where it could be tremendous damage.
Yeah.
You know, and with the protected person's bill of rights invokes a civil action, right, for the breach of the privacy of the individual. And there's a specific line item in there about, you know, protecting their privacy, and you know, there's some overlap with some other provisions. So in theory, I mean, the issue always becomes, in order to enforce these things, you're putting the burden potentially on protected person and their counsel to make people do the right thing versus what they're doing, and that can be, I think, challenging. But it does seem to exist. I would argue that that could be.
Yeah, but I think to force someone to have to file a new lawsuit would be more convenient, probably, to go to Judge Sherman and say, you know, this interested party is breached the confidentiality rights of the protected person, and she'd be in a position, if she chose, to impose the inherent power of the court to order contempt. It's a more direct way to deal with the problem. So, well, I'm thinking, and you make a great point, Judge, because as you're touching on, in order for the contempt to be enforceable, there has to be a warning or a notice that the violation is contemptible. So I think if it's in the court order, you solve the problem. I think that the orders reflect the fact that that the records confidence, the disclosure of confidential records outside of interested parties, which is a defined term, will result in or may result in contempt. You're good to go when you have that chapter 22 hearing. Okay.
I maybe just get tired of talking about here. For example, they were talking about confidential medical records and the disclosure to non-interested parties by third party, interested parties, and the guardian. Because, for example, a guardian has become the legal representative, and a guardian needs to disclose medical information to proposed care facilities.
Sure.
So the care facilities have this information in order to determine whether they can be the person's level of care. So I want to be careful if we're crafting orders, rules, legislation, and we're not capturing the necessary work of a guardian in needing to disclose certain types of information to care providers so that they can effectuate the guardianship.
Right. There's a there's a trail to protect that data in those disclosures. I think what Cassandra is worried about is disclosures by competing siblings or whomever, where they share this stuff with cousins and aunts and uncles and Lord knows whomever else, the neighbor across the street. And that seems to be a problem, at least in Douglas County, from Cassandra's point of view. Okay, so Judge, I think we ought to take a look at the use of language in order. The public.
Based on our compare financial headline and where there's evidence of fraud, it has to run around the church and all the office as well. So I think we just want to be careful about that form and make sure we're getting what we wanted to add and not being overly broad.
Okay. Any other points that anybody wishes to make today about amendments or modifications to legislation?
I sent an email about this, and I don't know that if it went out. So I've been attending a lot of the interim committee meetings. There are some guardianship bill draft requests that have already been voted forward. I thought I might share them at this point so that folks are aware of what captures the public's attention. It's very different than what practitioners might be paying attention to. The committee regarding veterans, older adults, and individuals with special needs, they approved the bill draft request creating a new statutory framework for sterilization in guardianship. There was a lot of concern that the current statute doesn't set a clear enough burden of proof and certain requirements. And when I say sterilization, it could be, a person who's 80 who needs a hysterectomy, they still have to go get court approval for that, or it's a younger individual. The cases that we've had as a division sadly often involve guardians who believe they have the right to order this and go ahead and do it using just their order establishing guardianship. So the legislation that is going to move forward with the bill draft request talks about procedures where the guardian approaches the court and says, we would like to perform this procedure. What we see are parents and guardians who initiate the procedure out of convenience or their own opinion about the person's reproductive rights, and the doctors go ahead and do it. So, but there is legislation moving forward. If it does get in front of a guardianship court, that was voted on unanimously by the committee. There was also the supportive decision making bill draft request. I believe it's 134, so it does have a number now. And that one is the Doherty and Ms. Nelson assisted with drafting the language for that. And then Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada and Bailey Borderlands, which I'm pronouncing her name right, appeared in the South to voice support, and it moved forward. There's actually, with the discussion of powers of attorney, I remembered that the interim committee, Senator Woodhouse's interim committee regarding the cognitive and behavioral care of older adults, actually did a BDR regarding powers of attorney. It was conceptually meant to address the rights of someone to continue to make a power of attorney as if they received the diagnosis that might otherwise preclude them. So there might be a place already for us to offer commentary or suggestions because that bill draft request already was moving forward. And then tomorrow, or the day after tomorrow, is the deadline for our division bill draft request. And the one we submitted is Adult Protective Services. So right now, we are one of three states that is only age 60 and up. And then Child Protective Services handles up to age 18 or if they're still in school beyond 18. So the goal is to expand that. We have Victims of Crime Act funding. We put in for administration on community living funding and are obviously asking for state funds to address that. And while we're in the statute cleaning things up, I have included some language to hopefully bolster the right of protected persons counsel to receive confidential records from the state regarding investigations of abuse, so that is in there. But I just wanted to share that those activities are going on, and then the Task Force on Alzheimer's Disease has a recommendation that they're putting into their state plan that if anybody would like to comment on that. I'm turning it in this week, and then they're going to vote on it in September. And the goal is to include education in ethics courses in law schools regarding representation of protected persons and the rights of individuals. So we're hopefully addressing what I would call predatory lawyering, where somebody is maybe borderline and needs assistance, but individuals are taken to a lawyer to pretty much sign exploitive documents just to recognize how to represent someone effectively under the ethical rules. And then also a suggestion that there be CLE opportunities for attorneys to train in this specific population, you know, understanding how to communicate with folks, understanding, you know, maybe it takes a little bit longer, but there's ways to reach this and maintain that attorney-client relationship. And I think our legal aid organizations do a really great job of that, but obviously if we have other attorneys coming in, it might be encouragement to figure out the exact range of those conditions. So I just thought I'd share that those things are all percolating. And there was one also, and I did apologize to Ms. DeBoer, and I think she forwarded it to Ms. Kelly. There was a bill regarding adjusting Section 253 of the Nevada Revised Statutes that I had been asked to submit some language for, and a suggestion of allowing public guardians to receive referrals for cases from law enforcement agencies and protective services. And I didn't mean for that to come under cover of, you know, that they weren't aware of it, but it did get approved. It's in the same BDR as the power of attorney adjustment, and then I would look forward to involving everybody if there's a discussion to be had. And I think the idea is if the legislature decides they do not want to address it, then we'll have an answer as far as how referrals fit into the new statutory framework and their appetite for allowing that. So that's kind of where we're at.
Well, what
exactly
do you are
It's 100, it's in the 100s. If you look, it will say it comes out of the cognitive and behavioral care of older adults. There was like three conceptual amendments right before it was voted on, so there's no specific language. But the idea was that the public guardians cannot receive confidential information unless they are, unless the guardianship is in place. And so there was some back and forth about how do we get people help who might need help, and what's the appropriate way to do that, which I think is a lot of what we're all talking about. Is we may know that someone is in great need, but how do we balance their privacy rights and their independence against wanting to be of assistance? So, and then I'm the legislative liaison for our division, so it's my job to track these things. If this is any use, you know, I can share anything that comes up guardianship related. And Senator Canizaro has a bill draft request that just says about guardianship. I don't know what it's about. We're going to discuss it with her when I'm in Vegas next month. And so those sorts of things. You want to keep track on maybe there's opportunities to bring these great suggestions into bills that are already moving forward.
Yeah. One thing I would like to see, and I think it echoes quite a bit Judge Jordan's comments were, is I'd like to see, and notice that guardians are an exemption for the ECF report to be reported to the guardian, as long as they're not subject to those reports. But I'd like to see the court, if somebody is subject to a guardianship, that the other aging services notify the court of the receipt of those reports. That way, there's no. Well, I was notified as a report received. I don't necessarily get the findings. And so the judge asked me about the findings of a case where we made the ECF report, but we didn't get a finding. And so I've got the individual protected. I've taken care of that problem. But she wanted to know what the outcome of the investigation was, and I don't know. And I'd like to see those things being specifically reported to the court. And they are not, for whatever reason, included in the exception. And I don't see why they shouldn't be.
Don?
I don't know if we're needed to break or not, but I would love a moment to address temporary guardianship.
Correct.
Possibly if something there. Do you want me to address that now?
Sure. Go ahead.
Can we touch on this before in the commission? And I know everyone's heard bits and pieces of this, but I just wanted to ask, how many people here, by show of hands, have seen a situation where a facility sends someone to the hospital and they won't take them back? I mean, I'm surprised at that too, but it happens all the time. So what happens is, if a caseload stops, or something, anything goes wrong, or a person has cardiac issues, or for any reason that the facility doesn't want them, they will call, say they have an accident, and then they'll call the hospital, and the person goes to the hospital. When they get to the hospital, typically it's going to take up, or it could be a homeless person, in other scenario. Typically it takes us at least a couple of weeks to analyze the person having a family member, are they going to get better, are they going to be healed. Then we, because we don't want to push the temp envelope, even though I know the judges here, I'm very grateful, I've been very kind and considerate of considering those conditions, but we estimate that in our clients, and not clients, but our caseload, we probably publish maybe 30 to 40% of the time, because there's no family members there to notify of the person has patient on. And so publishment is going to be before we have. And then your citation runs for 20 days. That because after the running of the 4 weeks, then you have 20 days. So we have a couple weeks to get started, we have 4 weeks, and we have 20 days. And then, even if we get our hearing, then there's a hearing date issue, you're honestly very close to 3 months out by the time we get the regular guardianship put in place. Then from there, we have a 10-day notice period. And I want to echo what some people said here, that the reality of the situation is most, and I'm curious what they would say up north, I know Daniel spoke to the office a little bit, most of the time when you try to place someone, you have a couple days where you're going to lose a death. You just can't, you're not going to be able to get that. So by the time we send you a 10-day notice out to everyone, and then try to get replacement done. And then you factor into that if the court appointing counsel opposes it, which it may be something that they have that right obligation to do that, but that will slow it down. What we're finding is it's not like it's a rarity. It is a common occurrence in these situations to go close to 4 months out before the hospital. So what started as a phone call, because someone had a minor airway infection or something, and somebody, and that has occurred in many cases, the person is medically okay at discharge. But we have to wait nearly 4 months to make this happen. And so, Justice Harris, you asked me, what is it about this legislation that contributes to that? And I think part of it is a lot of the states take their cue from this commission. And so, if this commission is very adverse to temporary guardianship, and I know there are reasons for that, then others take their cue from that. And pretty soon they get to this idea that we're not granting it temporary. And so what I'm saying is, in some cases, it actually would be merciful to the person to say, look, if we're very limited here and if we just want to get that Medicaid application going, it might be in their interest. And so here's where I'm going with this. In the statute right now, the temporary statute, they give a couple of examples of when a temporary might be granted. One would be if you feel that their utilities are going to go out. Maybe they have a pet at home, or they have their gas is dying. They get back to the same statute. It says that would be an example. It says including the not limited to a discontinuance of utilities or a foreclosure. And I have had cases, not with the judges here, but I have had cases where we had houses foreclosed and have all that, and we've had our tenants denied. And I believe that partly that's because this commission, sometimes in the past, and maybe where things are changing and getting better, they're appointing counsel now, that's a protection. They have 3 different judges randomly assigned. It's just a different day. I wonder whether we could envision the possibility of sending judicial discretion up to them, and they do it now to a certain extent, but you just make clear that the idea is someone with no paperwork in a facility, that creates the text, because the statute does reference their financial needs. Repeatedly in chapter 159, it says the guardian should do things consistent with their financial ability. And if there could be some way to acknowledge that in very limited cases, for example, if we knew that there was no relative, but that's information where there's no relative and we have to publish, that might be one factor that could say, you know what, in this case, we're going to let the temporary go forward, but we can at least get started on Medicaid. And then we'll see. We're going to watch over these standards, you know, the lawyers and their sergeants and whatever. We're going to make sure they toe the line, but we'll allow something to begin to happen, maybe even placement. Sometimes they get cured from the thing they were sent in, for example, dehydration. Sometimes that gets fixed in 3 days. But in many of these cases, I tell you, it's not rare, and they will sit there for 3 to 4 months. Now, some of you are probably thinking, well, it's a hospital fault, okay, that's true. Sometimes we're a little slow to file things, and there's reasons for that I can go into. But I'm asking the commission to consider whether they could be okay with some limited additions to that temporary statute, or maybe a way in a homeless person guardianship situation that we could lower the citation period, you know, maybe the 5 to 10 day notice, just so we don't reach a conclusion where these poor hospitals who are on fire, they're the first responders, but they're sometimes stuck with no Medicaid for 4 months, and Medicaid will reimburse backwards, and typically about 2 months is what they'll do. And so I just want to throw that out there. Is that a possibility that in the homeless context, that there could be some acknowledgement in the temporary, this might be as important as the utility for now?
So, John, why don't you prepare, take that statute, and do as I had requested earlier in another context with Kelly. Develop some red lines to it so that people can see it, read it, and determine whether how it looks.
How would that?
Okay.
I just have a quick question regarding the temporary. Are you thinking about an extra temporary or one that's been transferred
I would do it either way. I mean, just so long that we have to know that whoever, in fact, honestly, I don't like that project. I think it's good because the problem is right now it's our only, and there is something in the statute we had a little problem where if you try to shorten the time, I'll have to go back and look at that. But I think our feeling is that it's not that we're in love with that target, it's that we felt that it was one of our only tools, or else the person will be in the hospital with everyone else with the flu and sick and everything for 4 months. That's our only. So we can have to look at it.
Okay. So with that, unless there's any other suggestions, we prepared a fairly substantial list. Yes, Mr. Steele?
Yes,
so far,
I've always been troubled by the different definitions of who receives notice under the statute, and usually most
out of the position, unless you can already show they've been appointed
that if we could clean out that legislative incongruity between people who are religious to seeing potential blindness and people who need to know that they're consistent, then we could eliminate the potential for people not learning or not being informed of the possibility of their serving until after the appointment. Or, and I think you all seen this in the past, is that people don't get notices to meet with an expert's parents with us, for example, and then we come to the public and they're there, and that's the first time that they get a notice of what's happening. I think that this is legislative fit. This has a fit in the presentation and the voter statute, and then simply were surrounded in the definition of for an a whole agency for you. So that's just the point.
Okay, thank you. Anything else? All right, then we have meetings scheduled for September the 14th and November the 2nd. What I'd like to do by September 14th, I don't think it is likely that we can get all of the rules squared away by then, but as many as we can get tendered would be a great thing to include on that agenda. And by the 14th, we'll present in our materials a listing of the various issues that have been identified. Hopefully, we'll have a better grasp on the recording fees and investigative fees and child welfare fees, for lack of a better term, so we can take a look at those questions. We'll continue to reach out to others to see what other legislation is being considered or being vetted around the state, especially Senator Canizero, which he's got some broad sweeping approach to the item 9. I'm sure he has been worried about that. So then, the November, hopefully, we can vote up or deal with some of these legislative issues at the meeting on the 14th, and then refine, if necessary, anything left on the 2nd of November. So, anything else for today that anybody would like to raise or address? Okay, then we'll stand adjourned, and thank you everybody for your input and your participation today. I think we're good to go.
I don't know what to do.